Hi everyone, welcome back to Wake Up with Jenny and Friends. I hope you had an amazing weekend and you're looking forward to an amazing week ahead. Before we start the show, I just want to give a quick shout out to some of our sponsors this week. Thank you to Glass House Goods. They make such beautiful jewelry with inspiring sayings. Very funny, very inspiring. Go check them out, glasshousegoods.ca. All the codes as well will be in my link in my bio, so make sure you check that out. And last but not least, a big, big thank you to Evil Empire. Go check them out. They've got amazing gear, hoodies, t-shirts, riding gear, gloves, the best quality, and they even have a luxury line. Check them out at evilempire.com. Now, here's our show. You may recognize my guest as one of Canada's top journalists, particularly in the area of sports. He began his professional career as an anchor with TSN since the network's inception, more notably as the host of TSN's Off the Record, as well as TSN's First Up with Landsberg. Today, he hosts a different kind of conversation, one focused on mental health. It is an honor to have joining me today, Mr. Michael Landsberg. Hi, Michael.
You know, you could drop the Michael and just go with Mr. Landsberg.
Mr. Landsberg, it
Kidding.
is.
I'm the last guy who would ever ask for that. And in fact, when I say, call me Michael, and of course you should call me Michael. That's going to set the tone for this discussion, which should be, and I guess I'm diving right in, but I always
Yeah.
think that people like me who don't have medical expertise at all, right? I'm not a I'm not I don't have an expertise in helping people with their depression and treating them or something like that. But what I do have is the ability to speak like a person with depression. And I think that's really, really effective and powerful. And you can't do that, I don't believe, if you're Mr. Landsberg and it's all sanitized. So bring it the fuck on. Let's do this.
Well, I was trying to be fucking polite, but if you want to go that route, there
But
you
that's not impolite. That's just a way of communicating passion.
That's great. I'm so happy to have you here today. I think this is going to be a really great discussion about mental health. It's so important. A large portion of my audience are men, which I think adds to the conversation because I think there's when we talk about stigma about mental health, a large portion of that is focused on men not coming forward. So I'm glad to have this discussion with you, and I think it's going to be great. We've got a few funny things planned for later in the show.
Oh, you won't have to wait for the funny. I'm already on the funny, okay? Because let's face it, if you go old school and you're talking about mental health in a very somber and serious way, that's a turn off and tune out. So, like I said, let's have some fun.
Just shoot the shit. Yeah.
Shoot the shit.
How are you today? How is Michael doing today?
I am an official spokesperson for Michael, so I can tell you that Michael is doing well today.
Good.
Michael was thinking about that earlier today, as I do every day. And I
Yeah.
don't always share it with other people because I don't want to be the guy who's always like talking about it. But I think there's something really, really, really effective and important about talking candidly about your own mental health. And I think it's important for me because I'm trying to be an advocate for people with mental health, an advocate to them, to show them that I'm hope. Because I have been in a spot where I was not okay for a long period of time, where I was the furthest thing from okay. And I'm not there at this point in my life. So that's a reason for others to hope. You can make it to where I am if I believe you continually search for something that's going to get you there. But also, when I say I'm not having a great day, I think that shows others that I'm not selling false hope. I'm selling hope. There's no real cure for me of mental illness, but there is a treatment for it. So I think both sides of that are important, and it's important to send both of those messages.
And I think what's key too for a lot of people, especially for those people who know you and recognize you as a personality on TV and if I may say so, a celebrity. I don't know how you are with that terminology if you're
I can answer that for you.
yeah.
I'm fine with it, but I think it requires kind of a footnote,
Mm.
especially, I mean, my celebrity, obviously, since Off the Record, I think our last show was 5 years ago. So obviously, if celebrity is based on recognition, then I'm less of a celebrity. I used to call myself a B celebrity, and the only reason why people knew me was because I hosted a show. But I also think that if someone recognizes you, first of all, it's kind of a, it's a fun thing. Like if people say, oh, it doesn't make any difference to me, that's silly. It's nice, but it's not technically even a compliment, because the nature of your job, when you do a TV show and 100,000 people watch you every day at 6 o'clock, people are going to recognize you, right? I mean, that's just a fact. That doesn't mean necessarily that they're complimenting you. So yeah, I'm good with it.
Yeah. And the only reason I bring that up is because I think it's important for people to know and recognize and see that it's depression is something that affects everyone. Mental health is something that has an effect on everyone. You know, mental health is a sneaky bitch. She'll go after anyone. Doesn't matter your class, your race, your socioeconomic standing. It's, you know, and so it's, you know, I think sometimes some people may have a misconception that it only happens to certain groups of people. And it helps to see, you know, people who we know or people who we recognize and say, oh, well, he has, you know, this career, or he's done these things in his life, or this person is, you know, on this sort of status, and they're struggling too, or they're dealing with mental health too. And yeah, that sounds familiar, because I have that too, and I've experienced that too. And it's building that sort of camaraderie and saying, okay, well, if this can happen to you, then I don't feel so bad about having these same kinds of feelings and thoughts.
Yeah, I think it's empowering for people. I'm going to use that word 3 times tonight. I've just used one, so I'll dole them out judiciously. Yeah,
we have a limit, so
So I'm going to use the empowering word only 2 more times. Okay. There's a couple of things that I think the message that it sends off without saying the message is, number one, it's like, okay, I have had a severe mental illness in my life, and I have been treated successfully, and then I relapsed, and then back and forth, and I'm not cured. I'm on medication today, and I will be the rest of my life. But I think the message it sends is that I'm not a loser, right? Like people go, oh my God, I can't come out and share. If people find out, they're going to think I'm a loser. Well, you can call me lots of things. And I've been called lots of things over the course of my career. I'm always that, I have been that guy that people go, I like him. And people go, oh God, I hate that guy. He's so arrogant. But no one looks at me and thinks I'm weak. So I think there's a great statement that is, there's no need to speak it, which is, okay, I'm not weak, which you can tell, and I have a mental illness. And the other thing is that, you know, the arrogance with which I have been accused of being back, I think before I started talking more about mental health, also sends off a message, which is, well, you know, he does not seem like a guy who should have this mental illness. Maybe if I can't tell with him, maybe I can't tell with my brother or my sister or my spouse, you know, because I was never the face of what you would call depression, because the lesson is that you can wear the mask. I can pretend to be anything that I think you want me to be. And that's a really, really important lesson.
And two, do you think it was part and parcel of the persona you had to portray in the particular genre that you were in? You know, when you're talking about sports and you're interviewing wrestlers and you're, you know, doing all these interviews and, you know, asking the tough questions, you know, you've got to sort of have that confidence and that, you know, that gusto to be confident to ask that.
You know, but for the first day I was on television, from the first day I was perceived that way. And, you know, at a certain point, it didn't take long for me to kind of move past it and go, I don't care. I mean, I haven't really described it as often as I heard it. I mean, like literally every day I would think, especially when social media really took off, I would hear every day, 3 things. Landsberg is arrogant. Landsberg has had plastic surgery, and Landsberg wears too much makeup. I heard that every day.
Right.
And at a certain point, very quickly, I didn't care. Like, who cares? You don't do TV to make friends. And I also know that, and maybe I'm being arrogant by talking about how I'm not arrogant. So technically I'm boasting about it, but I'm just a really nice guy.
Just a regular guy.
But I'm nice. I'm nicer than most. That's the point that I would often think, oh my God, not only am I not a bad guy, I'm nice to everyone. I treat everyone with respect. I'm never rude to people. You know, I never carry myself like, hey, look at me. I'm on television. I'm just, so I kind of find that ironic, but also I kind of wore it as a badge of honor.
Yeah. Except when you're trying to get into restaurants, then you'll just pull out that TV card like right away, right?
Yeah. Or put on my fake voice. That was, of course, all pre-pandemic when we used to go to restaurants.
But. Oh, God. It's been a whirlwind for that. You have started a wonderful organization alongside your daughter, which I want to talk about a little bit later on in the show. Mm-hmm. But if you could sort of take us back for the audience who's listening today, take us back to your challenges with mental health and that defining moment, which I know you've talked about on your podcast as well, Isolation Nation, and we'll talk about that as well. But take us back to your struggles with mental health and that defining moment that made you feel like you were comfortable to come out publicly with your challenges and your struggles.
Right. So it's my earliest memories, and I'm going to talk really fast because I got a lot to say and not a lot of time to say it. So it's
we have as much time.
You don't know. I mean, like, so I'm going to edit on the fly. I'm going to talk fast, but I think you can understand because one of the things you do as a professional broadcaster is you learn to get as much information as possible in and not ever breathe. So when I was a kid, one of the first things that I can remember is experiencing anxiety. In particular, I had general anxiety disorder for sure, but I also had a phobia called emetophobia, which is a fear of throwing up, a fear of being around people who threw up, the fear of throwing up myself. If I was at a movie and someone was going to throw up, I was freaked out. Mm-hmm. And that shaped a lot of the decisions that I made early in my life because I wouldn't ride on a bus to camp because I was afraid that someone would get sick on the bus. That's just kind of one example of how it really did affect my choices in life and my flexibility in life. Like there was things I just wouldn't do. So that was with me and still is to this day with me, but I cope with it much better than I did when I was 6 years old. But I, without a doubt, would have benefited hugely if I was watching this right now. And there's a guy on here talking like I am about emetophobia and the fear of throwing up. When I was 10 years old, if I would have seen someone else talking about it, it would have changed my life. Yeah. All of a sudden, I would have felt like, oh my God, I'm not the only one. Oh my God, I didn't bring this upon myself. Oh my God, it doesn't mean that I'm weak. This is awesome. But I never heard of another person until I actually started talking about mental illness. And I found out that there's actually a name for it, emetophobia. And in audiences that I've spoke to, I would say half the time there's someone who'll put up their hand if I say, anybody else here have that fear? So that would have helped me. And that's one of the things that shapes my attitude about sharing is that, you know, it's a huge boost to hear that someone is experiencing what you are experiencing. Because all of a sudden, if it's the first time, it's the first time in your life that you have felt like, wow, you know, I'm not the only one. And this can't be my fault if somebody else is experiencing the same thing. So carry that through my life, anxiety in my life, lots of just general anxiety. And when my daughter was 3 years old, she was diagnosed with a serious eye condition. I just had no coping mechanism whatsoever. Mm. It crippled me mentally, even though I didn't talk about it. Because I mean, part of it is just natural. I mean, you have a kid and your kid is sick, you're going to be obviously anxious. Mm-hmm. But I think that for me, it was a spiral that was not typical of what one would experience unless one also had an underlying anxiety problem. And what I found was that when I was most anxious, I also started to get depressed, something I'd never experienced before. But when I would fall into the deepest anxiety position, I would find myself starting to get depressed. So fast forward now to 1998, the second year of Off the Record. I was overcome by anxiety, and my anxiety was so bad that it started to turn to depression, but I didn't know it. I mean, this is one of the things I tell people. You don't necessarily know that you have a mental illness issue. Because they happen so slowly. Like depression, you know, for me was just a tiny, tiny, tiny change in me that I didn't know what was happening. And it took an accumulation of 6 months of these tiny changes for me to go, wow, there's something wrong with me outside of what I already knew was wrong with me. Right. Then I clicked in I talked my way into a psychiatrist's office, which no one should have to do, but that's our system. And mm-hmm. I started on medication, and fast forward now, I'd gone off of it. I went back on after a relapse 4 times. And in 2008, I have it on my arm, 11-24-08-YUL-1-0400. And that is November 24th, 2008, Montreal, Marriott Hotel, room 521, 4 a.m. in the morning. At that point, I understood why people take their own lives. I was not a danger to myself, but I knew that there was only a finite amount of time that I could keep going in the pain that I was in. And fortunately, as was the case 4 times previous, treatment helped me. And in 2009, when I was feeling better, probably as I'm feeling today, I was interviewing a hockey player, Stéphane Richer. Stéphane Richer was a Montreal Canadian great. I read just like literally 30 seconds before I got up from my desk to go to the green room to greet him and the other guests. I read that he battled depression in the 1990s. So when I saw him, I said, "Hey, Stéphane, just come outside for a second. I want to ask you something. I don't know if you talk about this, but I would love to ask you how you're doing with depression, because I know you battled it in the 1990s. Would that be okay?" And he said, "I'd rather not talk about it." And I said, "Okay, that's why I asked in advance. But if you'll talk about it, I'll talk about it." And he said, "What would you talk about?" And I told him, and he said, "Let's do it." So we went on the air. We talked for maybe, let's say, 2 minutes. And that was it. I never thought about it after that for the next, let's say, 3-4 hours. I had never spoken about it on television before because I thought no one would really care about my challenges in life. I didn't think there was a benefit to it. I wasn't ashamed or embarrassed, but I just never spoke about it because I thought, who cares? So at 6:40, the show went to air 6 o'clock to 6:30. At 6:40, I started getting emails forwarded to me. They were sent to the show and they came to me. And I was at a restaurant in Toronto with my wife and family and her family. And these emails changed the course of my life. Mm. Like everything about my life changed when I read how important it was that someone heard two guys, and you mentioned men when we started, talking about mental illness, their own, without seeming ashamed, mm-hmm. embarrassed, or weak. And that kind of like, for me, like I said, changed my life. And there were 22 emails, 20 of them were from men, which was a reflection of the demographics of the show, probably 60% male, but also the problem that men had. And all of these, all of these said the same thing. They all said, "Hey, Michael, I've never told anyone what I'm going to tell you. And I'm only telling you this because I watched you and Stéphane Richer talk, and you guys didn't seem to be..." Different words were used. "You didn't seem to be weak. You weren't embarrassed. You didn't sound like losers." Right. "And because of that, I'm telling you, I have battled depression. And I'm only telling you that. I'm only telling it for the first time." So it was kind of the kickoff for me of that part of my life.
Yeah. And I think that for men too, it's great to have a confidant. Someone maybe that they look up to rather than just a friend or a family member, someone, an outside person that they can say, "Okay, I relate to that and I recognize that and I go through that too." That's a big deal, I think.
It's a big deal. And I have a little saying for just about anything you could talk about in mental health. And for this, I have that loneliness that we feel with mental illness is never lessened by the number of people around us. It's finding one person who understands us. If you find one person who has gone through the same thing, if you find one person who can say, "Me too," that is so important and so liberating. And that can be the difference between life and death.
Absolutely. And I resonate with what you say too, with anxiety. I struggle with anxiety quite a bit. And I found the same thing. It's not something I really talk about, particularly on this show, because this show is sort of my, I have my business and my work outside of here, but this show is just sort of my creative outlet, my fun thing to do. And it's enjoyable. And I have, great conversations with people. But there was one moment last year where I had posted something about anxiety, and I got so many messages. You have anxiety. Well, I have anxiety too. What do you do? It was almost like people didn't think that because of all the things I do and all of the, you know, conversations that I have, and I use humor as part of my healing and coping. But it was almost people didn't realize that, oh, you have anxiety too. And the messages were really lovely, and people felt like they could open up a little bit. And yeah,
because you're safe, right? I mean, all of a sudden, yeah. Now, I mean, why do people send me these emails that said, I'm going to tell you something I've never told another person in my life? And the reason is because they knew I was safe. They knew they wouldn't feel judged, and they knew that I understood it. I was in Edmonton 4 years ago giving a talk. Afterwards, a woman came up to me and was just crying, sobbing inconsolably. And I said to her, I don't think this is sadness. It seems like it's like sort of raw emotion from a number of different areas. And she kind of nodded her head. So I said, take your time, come back. I'll stand here. You know, I'll talk to other people. And when you want to talk, let's talk. So she comes back to me and I say, so what is it that has you so emotional? And she said, for the first time in my life, I feel understood. And that was kind of a jolt to me. Of the value of not only sharing, not only saying, hey, I have depression and anxiety, but talking about what it feels like to me, because there's some things we all have in common. Like I've spoken 200 times to audiences. So, I mean, thousands of people. And I've said, look, if you have battled depression and you haven't felt the four things I'm going to talk about now, put up your hand and tell me, right? I want to know. It's not like you're arguing with me, but I want to know if anyone hasn't felt it. So far, no one has ever put up their hand. Four things that we all feel: the loss of the ability to experience joy, the loss of self-esteem, the sense of loneliness that we're the only ones, and the sense of hopelessness that we're never getting better. Other people get better, not us. And when she heard me say that, I think especially the loss of the ability to experience joy and self-esteem, she kind of like really felt like someone has gone through and is going through the same things as her.
You mentioned one time, and I believe it was in a TikTok, you mentioned this about the saying people use quite often, that you're not alone. And your sentiments were sort of a contrast to what people usually buy into, I'll say. And I would venture to agree with you. And I would say, well, yeah, we are alone. Because we feel alone. And when we're in those states of depression and anxiety, and, you know, our mind, our brain, our body tells us, okay, we're alone in this. We're, you know, so for someone to come and say, oh, you're not alone, it's not very comforting. It's not very, you know, like, you know, there's no one with you. There's no one, you know.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, obviously I agree, because you were saying, Michael, you said this, so you said you agree. So now I agree with you agreeing with me.
Well, we
unravel
agree.
That later on, but I think that it's a bit, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, right? Like, people are trying to be nice. So it's I'm not criticizing them, but you know, as you spoke about, this sense of loneliness, you know, is means that you actually do feel alone. But beyond that, you know, would you ever say to someone that that is undergoing chemotherapy for cancer? And you know, they're going through treatments. Right. Would you ever say to them, hey, you know, I'm going to be with you there physically, but you're not alone? Sure, that's true. You're not alone physically, but we all battle things internally that we can't share with anyone, right?
Yeah.
The pain that we feel, the actual pain that you feel from a physical ailment, or in this case, you know, mental ailment, it can't be shared with anyone. And so that bothers me, the you're not alone, only because I think it kind of minimizes it. It's like, and you know, there's a few things like that. The other thing that I really dislike is when people say, we all go through it. It's like, what? We all go through what? Oh, like, you know, depression. We all go through it. No, we don't all go through it. We all have bad times in our lives.
We all have
sadness in our lives. It's an inevitability, but we don't all go through the illness of depression. So
yeah,
that one really pisses me off.
Yeah. And I do want to make a note, though, there that there are varying degrees of depression.
Yes.
There are different severities of depression. Some people are able to overcome it fully at some points in their lives and deal with it. You know, some required lifestyle changes and it's something like that. Or some people, you know, need to be on medication. And all of those are acceptable and good and fine options. And so there's resources out there for everybody, no matter what. Like, I don't want anybody to think, well, I don't think my depression is that bad, or maybe I don't really have depression, or I'm not as bad off as this person or that person, and then not seek help, because there are different severities and there are varying degrees of depression.
Right. But also, I think what you have to do, and you owe yourself, and this is something that I'm, you know, like, think is hugely important now, coming out of the pandemic, is, you know, is differentiating between what is the normal anxiety and sadness that we might all experience from what we've gone through for the last couple of years. What's, you know, when does that cross over into a diagnosable, treatable mental illness? You know, I use this example in Fredericton, where I was speaking this week. Beautiful place. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Who knew the East Coast was so awesome?
Who knew?
Who knew? Why wasn't I told this? But I said, you know, like, look at depression. My dad died in January. That makes me sad, but it doesn't make me depressed. Sadness, as I said, is an inevitability in life, right? But it's not an illness. It's a situation. I remember a year ago, I went for a biopsy and the doctor said to me, hey, you know, I'll have the results in 3 weeks. For 3 weeks, I was pretty anxious about it, but that's not anxiety disorder. That's just normal life. So I think that you owe it to yourself, if you're going, I don't know, to find out. And, you know, one of the things that I say to people is, you know, especially for severe mental illness, is it doesn't come and go. It's not like, you know, like it's this thing that's hovering over your head and enveloping your body that you can't get away from, right? It's not like if you're severely depressed, it's not like you can be happy about some things, like if something great happens, I can feel it. No, you can't feel anything. And that is, you know, for me, the worst thing that I've experienced in my life. So I think that people need to, you're right. I mean, there is different kinds of depression, different kinds of severity, and then there is life, which can mask itself as being an illness, but really is.
Yeah. And I like to always point out to people that the focus should be on things that bring joy into your life when you're trying to deal with things, not necessarily look for the happiness, because happiness is fleeting. To me, I could be happy that I put my shoes on. I could be happy that I took a shower. But if you look for things in life that bring you joy, that's a whole other way that fulfills your life.
Let me jump on that and just say that I agree with that. But I think a marker for mental illness is the loss of the ability to experience joy. Mm-hmm. So it's like you have a cold and you take a bite of pizza that you love and you can't taste it. Well, that to me is, you know, it's a loss of temporarily the ability to taste food. Well, I think that, you know, with depression, you lose whatever it is in your brain, chemical wise, that needs to be there for you to feel joy, is somehow not functioning properly. And for, I mean, I've actually never met anyone who said with depression that they could experience joy. It's just kind of like a fundamental, like nothing feels good.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. I've definitely experienced those times in my life where you just feel numb. You just feel empty. And there's definitely been some times where I could not get out of bed. You know, and I think that we have to be kind to ourselves in those moments and recognize that it's okay to be in that space, and not feel guilty for it. Because I think the guilt can be overwhelming sometimes on top of already feeling shitty.
Right, right. And that's why, you know, the golden rule, right? I mean, most people know the golden rule. It would be what?
Don't eat the cheese.
Don't eat the cheese. Right. Well, don't eat the cheese.
Oh, that's not it. Okay.
Well, that can be a golden rule, but not, you know, like I think the problem with cheese is that it when it's really good, it can actually smell really bad. So now you're going, I don't know. I just did the smell test. But obviously the golden rule is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But I think especially with depression, you need to learn the opposite of that. Do unto you as you would do unto others. It seems like we're so much nicer to everybody else. Mm-hmm. You know, we everybody else with an illness, you know, we cut them slack and we understand you can't be yourself. And we're so nice to them, but then we beat ourselves up. Why am I like this? How can I do this to the people around me? You know, why am I unable to do the things that I want to do? Like, what the hell's wrong with me? So I think that, I mean, I agree with you that we need to be kinder to ourselves, but that's way easier said than done.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when we're in those struggling moments, for sure. Definitely. There's been such a greater conversation the last couple of years about mental health. And I think that that's amazing. But I wonder, I certainly have recognized this, and I wonder if you spotted this at any point too, that at some point in the social media craze of talking about mental illness, there have been sort of a section or a group of people who have, I'll say, jumped on the mental health bandwagon of not necessarily really having a mental health issue, but more so of making a farce of it and saying, because I organized this, I have OCD, or I really don't want to go to this place, so I don't know, I have major anxiety. And it's sort of, in a way, devalues or diminishes the actuality of what some people struggle with. Have you noticed that at all?
You know, I would say that I'm incapable of determining, you know, who's legit and who's not, right? I mean, that's, first of all, I'm not a professional. And second of all, I'm a big believer that you need to err on the side of assuming that someone is actually as sick as they say they are. It's kind of like, I'm trying to make sure I got this expression right, better to let 10 guilty people go free than convict one innocent person. Mm-hmm. So I think in the case of, and this is just the way I look at it, that it's better to have perhaps being taken advantage of by people who are not genuinely mentally ill than it is to call out that one person who actually is really struggling, and you have thought erroneously that they're kind of putting on the act. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. My concern in saying that is just because we talk a lot about, you know, wondering, do I have this or do I not have this? Should I see someone? Should I not get diagnosed? And I think that in minimizing sometimes when people joke about it, and this is my own personal opinion, but I know some people that joke about it quite frequently, that it may make it a lesser concern for someone who is actually struggling through something more severe and may not feel like they should go and see someone or talk to someone because maybe they feel like it's not a big deal.
Yeah, it would be ironic, given that this is the illness, mental illness is the one that people hide and sometimes will do anything to avoid people finding out about their illness. It would be ironic if there's people who actually make up the story, right? Like all of the people who go, no, I don't want anyone to know. It's really weird to actually conceive that someone is making it up. But I'm sure that does happen. And I'm sure that, I think it does devalue the pain that people with genuine mental illness feel. And people see, the problem is there's no test, right? You know, it's not like I can go to my doctor, have my doctor take blood, and then 2 days later call me and say, hey, I just got the results back. Your depression level's through the roof. Right. That doesn't exist. So a lot of people, as I was saying, they don't know really what it is. They don't know if they're sick and they don't know if they're not sick, but they think they might be, because normal life masks itself as mental illness so well that sometimes we don't know. And we know that people like sympathy, right? And people like to play the victim. Not all people, but some people do. So I would imagine it does manifest itself that way.
Yeah. How do you combat the tough days? What's your sort of checklist to recognize, okay, I see what's happening here and I feel like tomorrow is going to be a really shitty day? Or, you know, how do you get through those tough times?
I think I one of the things that I tell people is that there's a lot that you can't be responsible for. Like, I know for me, at my worst times with depression, that this was not self-inflicted. This was not me exposing myself because of weakness to an illness. Or it wasn't like I, in the old days, like they would say, don't go out when it's cold out with wet hair.
Right.
It's not like I did the equivalent of that for mental illness. So I never felt like it was self-inflicted. But I also never really thought about how... I'm trying to think of how to express what it is I want to express here. Mm-hmm. Tell me what your question was again.
So how do you combat those tough days? Like, right. Do you have a checklist of, you know, okay, I'm feeling like this, so I need to do this? And
yeah, so I think self-awareness is a huge thing. That's what I was trying to lead to. And I got off target and now I'm back. Self-awareness is understanding.
Brought to you by Back in Action.
I'm back. I'm back and I'm bad, but a good kind of bad because I got a tattoo.
I love that.
So I think that self-awareness is one of the responsibilities that we have. If we're talking about, okay, you know, I have this mental illness, I have bad days, and it's a self-awareness that comes from living and remembering your experience. Like I'll, you know I did this, and now I'll talk to people about, oh my God, they're freaking out. You know, they had a really good 2 weeks. And now they're struggling. And I'll say, well, have you gone through this before? Obviously, knowing the answer is yes. Have you gone through this before? Yes. And what happened? Well, I felt crappy for a couple of days, but it turned around for me. I say, okay, well, that's the lesson that you got to learn. That's your own self-awareness. That is your responsibility. Do not make the assumption this time is different. If it's happened to you 500 times in your life and each time you bounce back, then you got to use that to your advantage. So it took me a long time to learn that, but I used to be able to take a bad day and make it worse by saying, well, oh God, what happens if today that's a bad day is the same thing tomorrow? And then what about if it's 3 days in a row, you know, are my meds not working anymore? Am I relapsing? So I would take a bad day and make it worse, but also I would have the ability to take a good day and make it bad. Oh my God, I feel so good. This is awesome. Oh my God, I just feel normal. See, if you've had it taken away, normal is awesome. So it's like, oh God, but I don't want to go back to living with the bad shit here. I don't want to go back to feeling crappy. Oh my God, what happens if tomorrow's a bad day? It's like, okay, well, I've just taken this gift of a good day and kind of, you know, like ruined it. So that to me is, it's having a firm grasp on my own history and using that to talk me through what might be a bad day. And, you know, it's like when it rains outside, you can't stop the rain, but you can stop the rain from making you wet. You can have an umbrella, you can put on a raincoat. I was going to say I could put on boots, but it's so undignified to be, you know, as a grown man wearing boots in the rain.
Rain boots. God.
Rain boots. We had a kid actually across the street from us when my kids were young.
Mail you out a rubber ducky.
Yeah. Well, no, but this kid was, his nickname was Rain Boots because he used to wear rain boots and it scarred everyone around him. Like, God, kid, no dignity whatsoever. But it's like, you know, it's raining. You can let the rain be on you, but not in you. I let mental illness on a bad day, I just go, you know what? I can't do anything about it. I can't get rid of it, but I don't have to embrace it. So I'm just going to let it be. I'm just going to go through my day. And if I feel shitty, I'm not going to think about what it means. And I find myself more capable of getting through a bad day.
Yeah. And I think you made an important point of recognizing, you know, after something happening 2, 3, 4, 500 times, that you recognize the signs and you say, okay, I've been here before. I've been through this before. Okay, my next step is this. I know I'm going to get through it. I know I'm going to make it, because otherwise it feels sort of like it's really a battlefield in your mind. You can have such a juxtaposition of thoughts and feelings going on, and you're like, well, you know, it's so conflicting. And we have to recognize too that, you know, this is my brain. This is my brain. It's a chemical thing that's happening in my brain. It's not my fault, but I can do things to help myself.
Yeah. You know, I think that's important from a couple of aspects. Number one, it's important because if you can find something that can make your day a little bit better, that's great. But number two, it also makes you feel like you have some control over your destiny, mental health wise. And that if you feel you are kind of exposed to the mental health gods and whatever their whim might be is going to take you down, that loss of control can be, you know, really difficult to contend with. Like, I know for me, when I've been at my lowest, I have felt like I have no control over this. There's nothing I can do to make myself better. And that is what provokes the sense of hopelessness that I think, you know, hopelessness is so much the key, I think, to suicide. You know, not to make the leap from one thing to another, but I don't think people tend to take their own lives or attempt to take their own lives when they have hope. It's when you think, I'm in so much pain now, and I will always be in this pain because nothing is going to make me better. That, because I know for me, you know, 11-2408-YUL-MH-521-0400, I had a feeling of hope because I had been through it before. But if I hadn't have been, that may have been, may have had a different outcome.
Yeah. And I think it's important too to recognize that everybody has different ways of coping and different things that help them. I know for me, you know, it might sound trivial to some, but for me, I know the foods that I eat and the amount of exercise I get, and what I listen to and what I read really have an effect on me personally, and my brain and the way I think and the way I feel, and the music I listen to. And it can really make a difference, you know, in those not so severe times, but really make a difference in brightening my mood, changing my thought process. And so there's lots and lots of resources out there and something for everybody. And that's the important thing.
Yeah. And that gets back to self-awareness, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, you have thought about not just the things, not just the negative side, but okay, what works positively for me? And, you know, for me, there are things that I can do now that will make me feel a little bit better. But I also know that when I was in the deepest, darkest hole four or five times, that there was nothing that I could do that changed anything. It was like every single second, no matter what I was doing, was painful. And my only goal was to get through that second so I could get to the next one. And my only goal in getting out of bed was to get back in bed. So it's like, okay, I can get out of bed, or I have to get out of bed, but that means I can get back in bed later on today. And nothing I did would deflect any of the pain. But now, you know, being better off, where my worst days are a 4 out of 10 and my best days are a 7.5, say, because of medication. But I think it's all about really understanding, though, you know, you're really looking at yourself and being aware of the things that are good and not so good for you.
How has it changed the dynamics of your family and the interactions with your spouse and your children now that you've sort of come out with this mental illness and challenges? And how is that for them when you're going through your dark times?
You know, I think there was no coming out for me. There was only a television coming out for me, meaning, you know, all my, well, not when I was a kid, I didn't talk to anyone about it, but depression, certainly, everybody in my life knew, everybody I work with knew. Okay. It was just, I never spoke about it on television. And again, not because I was ashamed or embarrassed, but because I just didn't see the value in it. But I kind of have a deal, especially with my wife, that I will always tell her when I'm having a bad day. Because, I mean, first of all, I would coach people and have coached people many times, where if you're not open and honest with your partner, you have no chance. Like to live with someone who's got depression and not have them tell you that you are actually sick and that it's not because of them. It's not that they're not making you happy anymore. It's not that you're dissatisfied with your life. If you don't share the fact that you have this illness, one of this illness symptoms is, you know, loss of joy, being reclusive, all of those things. If you don't share that, you have no choice because your partner would think, oh my God, it's my fault, or he wants out. So with my wife, especially, she says, just tell me when you're having a bad day. And it's good that she tells me that because my inclination is to not tell her, not because of shame, but because I'm wired not to complain. Unlike many men, when I get a cold, I actually don't complain. So it's unnatural for me to say, you know, I'm just not having a good day, but I owe it to her, I think, to tell her that. But it's always been part of the discussion. I mean, look at me now, you know, like you can hear how I'm yakking about it. My kids, you know, have heard me talk like this, you know, a million times. So I think we've always had an open house when it comes to mental illness. I'm sure if my daughter was here listening to me, she'd be like, oh God, here he goes again, you know, 11-24-08, or, oh, you know, fight for your happiness, or proud of the shower. These are all little sayings, or the golden rule, or whatever. Yeah, here he goes.
Well, this parlays nicely into, another thing I wanted to talk about. You have started, an organization with your daughter called Sick Not Weak. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I guess it was, I don't know, maybe one of the first speeches I ever gave was at Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto to a group of, they had a, I don't know where they were, whether it was people that had donated or whether it was, I don't know what the group was, but they had a guest speaker series and I was one of the speakers talking about mental health. And I said, you know, I'm kind of new to this, but it seems like everybody here agrees with everything I say. And that's not the case. There is a stigma around mental illness, right? Yeah. And people do perceive it as a weakness, not an illness like cancer or lupus or heart disease, that it's somehow different. I want someone to at least have the guts to say, yeah, you know, I don't see it the same way as those illnesses. I go, like, I'm not going to be mad. The opposite, in fact. I just want to know that I want to hear you express it. And some guy put up his hand. And we had a really good chat. And I said, you know, I really respect the fact that you said something, which to many in this room probably is unpopular, right? Mm. But I said, but, you know, here's what I will say, you know, I'm sick, but I'm not weak. And that's what you need to take away from this conversation, is that this is not a reflection of a personal weakness on my part. And it kind of just stuck. I don't know how it went from that one night to being something that I started using the hashtag. And then in 2016, we launched a not-for-profit called Sick Not Weak. And then in 2018, we got a charity license, Sick Not Weak Charitable Foundation. And it kind of, like, you know, it's one of those names that's more than a name, right? It's a statement, you know, it's an argument, you know, hey, I'm sick, but I'm not weak. You know, it's kind of, you know, it kind of, like, I say to people, hey, if I got in front of you and I was like hired to give a talk, or you were making a donation to the charity, and all I said was, you know, I got a mental illness, it's called depression. I have anxiety as well. It's debilitated me at times in my life, but you know what? I'm sick, but I'm not weak.
Yeah.
Then I would have at least, you know, I would have done something useful. It'd be really weird if I got in front of an audience and, you know, was going to talk for an hour or 90 minutes and only said 1 minute worth of material, but still significant. I'm sick, but I'm not weak. And people go, oh, I hate the use of the term sick. And I go, well, like, what do you want to call it then? You know, like, it's like, what is it? If it's not a sickness. I mean, that's kind of what I've devoted the last 15 years of my life to, is convincing people that a mental illness like depression is a sickness. But people go, well, why would you want to be known as sick? Well, it's not that I want to be known as sick. I'd rather be known as sick, though, than be known as weak, you know? So it's kind of like, you can't have it both ways.
I follow a lot of the work of Dr. Amen. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but he does all these brain scans and it's really, really interesting. And so when we talk about being sick, but not weak, he really addresses that in these brain scans. If you have a chance to check him out, I would highly recommend some of his content. But these scans, you can actually see for people who have maybe difficulty, maybe who aren't struggling with depression or mental illness, who have difficulty sort of grasping the idea of how people go through this or the visual, aspect of it. These brain scans, you can actually physically see the brain science, the holes in the brain, you know, how the brain is shaped and things like that. And it kind of gives a little bit more insight for possibly people who don't go through it. And even people who go through it, it's like, oh my gosh, that's what my brain looks like. And then you can kind of relate and say, okay, how can I fix this? How can I?
Right. But just the acknowledgement that actually there is some way to see your illness, because most illnesses, I mean, there are physical ways that you can detect it, whether it's through a biopsy or a blood test or some kind of scan, you know, an X-ray or an MRI or whatever. Most illnesses, actually, you can say, I'm making a diagnosis of this because of this. But until this point, and I'm aware of some doctors who are, you know, doing a lot of work in this area, this is total vindication for people. If you can say, okay, well, here's your brain scan partner who doesn't believe that I'm really sick.
Right.
And here's my brain scan, and you can see the differences. So you know what? Fuck you for thinking that this is self-inflicted and maybe I'm just looking for sympathy.
Yeah. And I like to joke too, when people say, you know, when I hear people say things like, you know, it's all in your head. I go, yeah, it fucking is actually.
Yeah. You know what? Not going to deny it. But you know, what's really, really explain this to me. What is mental illness? Like, why do we call it mental illness as opposed to mental health? Yeah. Or why do we not call it brain disease? Like Parkinson's is a brain disease, right? You know, no one calls Parkinson's a mental illness. And I think a lot of the stigma really stems from, and I'm not a big believer in, you know, in the semantics and how, you know, you can't say, like, it's offensive if you say, oh, that guy's crazy. Like, to me, and maybe this is just because I've always been armed against that. I never cared. I never saw myself as being anything other than sick.
Yeah.
But mental illness, like, I don't understand that, because the goal is to tell, what's the doctor's name you said?
Dr. Amen.
Dr. Amen.
Yeah, Dr. Daniel Amen. Yeah, Amen.
Doctor, because I know so many Dr. Amens. It's good that you clarified it was Daniel Amen and not the other Amens that I know.
Not the other Daniel.
It's this. No, okay. So I think that, you know, his goal, even though he might not state it that way, is to show people that mental illness is actually a physical illness of the brain. And when you call it a mental illness, I think that you conjure up a different result in people than if you called it a brain disease. I have a friend who's an ophthalmologist who was in a big hospital in Philadelphia. And he said, we don't use the term mental illness anymore. We use the term brain disease as, you know, describing depression and anxiety and all of the others that would used to be referred to as mental illness.
Yeah. And I think that's part and parcel of what sort of creates these stigmas, right? When we hear certain words, we think, oh, well, that's not me. That's not for me. I'm just going to put that to the side there. But it's sort of this, you know, it's the governing powers that be that create this terminology. It's like, why do they call it the Wuhan flu, but now it's called COVID, right? why do they have it? Why do we call it monkeypox, but originally it was C2798 or whatever it was. Do you know, it's just the way we name things and term things has an absolute effect on how we perceive things. So you're absolutely right. Yeah, definitely. If I were to ask you, what is mental health for you?
The absence of mental illness, for sure. You know, and I would equate it to this. If you had, you know, God forbid, you had a car accident, you were paralyzed from the waist down, or, you know, God forbid, you have a stroke. I don't know why I got to say God forbid. I mean, like, I don't think anyone's going, oh my God, he wants her to have a car accident.
He is that arrogant.
He is that, oh my God, and evil. But if you lost the ability to walk and you went for rehab and slowly you got it back to the point where you were back to where you were before, you would cherish every step that you took. You would go, oh my God, this is so unbelievable. I parked my car and I walked from my car, you know, into a restaurant. That's so great. But no one who hasn't had it taken away would ever say, oh my God, it's so awesome. I took my dog for a walk and my legs were working. I kind of look at it, mental illness that way. When you've had it taken away and you get it back, it's like, I celebrate what I can do now where I'm talking to you. I'm enjoying myself. I'm able to be myself. This, you know, to me, because I've lost the ability to do those two things. I like myself, all of those things. When I can be those things, I kind of cherish it. And I look at that as mental health. Mental health for me is the absence of mental illness.
Yeah. And I think it's important to, as you say, to celebrate the small wins too. That's such a huge thing, especially for me in my life. I celebrate the small wins.
Well, you know what? I got a saying for that. If my daughter, who I mentioned before, was in the room, she'd go, yeah, okay, Michael, tell I'm proud of the shower. So it's a hashtag that I use, proud of the shower, which is, you know, when again, back to the person that, you know, maybe has lost the ability to use their legs, you know, three steps is a massive accomplishment, right? It's like, oh my God, I am so proud of myself. I took three steps. Mm-hmm. Mental illness to me, if you do something that to other people, they would take for granted, like a shower, right? Like no one who has perfect mental health or good mental health walks around going, I took a shower today. I did it.
Well, but maybe some teenagers, I don't know.
Some teenagers who perhaps, or maybe their parents would celebrate that. But I think, you know, we need to celebrate what for us are big accomplishments, but for others would be really small. The bar is a lot lower, you know, instead of the bar being here, it's down like 2 inches above the ground. And if you get over the bar, if you can get out and take a shower, if you can go and do your job, if you can go and meet a friend for coffee, that is a reason to celebrate.
And I would even argue, not to play devil's advocate here, but I will, that the bar is not lower, but the bar is where you're at. Celebrating those small wins is important.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's a difference in what I said and what you just said. I think you just were looking to be superior. It's your show.
Well, that's probably correct.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's your show.
I have a lot of people watching.
Yeah, and they expect you to, you know, sponsors. Confrontation is really good for an interview, right? Mm-hmm. So you thought, okay, I'm going to take it to Landsberg. And I respect that. But your point was so like abstract. I have no idea what it even was.
I love that.
I said, you got to lower the bar and you're saying, well, you're not lowering the bar. It's just where the bar is for you, which I think is a valid point.
Yeah.
But
also, as he rolls his eyes.
You know, I noticed that in life, men don't really care if you roll your eyes at them, but women hate eye rolling.
Let's do it together on three.
Okay.
One, two, three.
And it's the noise. It's also the noise. It's not just this. It's.
I love it. But this is a good conversation that we're having. And I love that.
And I
love the banter and I love, you know, the challenges. And there may be things that, you know, you and I don't see eye to eye on or agree on. And that's part of like, that's a communicative process. And I love that. It's all about having a conversation.
Hey, I think that like on Twitter a lot, and I'm not looking to make this a political discussion, but I'm horrified by
but you're
Donald
running
Trump
next and, semester?
But I'm horrified by what Donald Trump has done to America and the direction that America is going. So I will tweet, you know, things out that say, you know, like that really show my point. And others will often respond by saying, hey, you know, why do you do that? Why do you respond to people who, you know, who clearly you can't convince them? And I say, well, other people need to hear the debate. You can actually learn a lot from hearing side A and side B. That gives you the chance to hear both of them. So I think there's something really, and just like the guy who I said, someone, please talk about it. Like, you know, we know the stigma exists. I think the discussion that he and I had was really good for others to be able to hear both sides and make a determination, you know, which side they were on.
Yeah. And I want to touch a little bit about some things that you are doing to bring about a greater conversation with that in terms of social media in your podcast. You have started a podcast called Isolation Nation, which is fabulous. And people can find that through your website and it's on YouTube as well.
That is true. Although we started doing it when I guess 3-4 months into the pandemic, we mm-hmm. started, because I felt like people were just like really freaked out about their mental health, you know, this feeling yeah. of isolation, which, you know, does things to us. It's funny though, my son who does battle anxiety just like me, my dog is now talking. Hold on one second.
That's okay.
Riggs, what's going on, bud? What do you want?
He wants in on the conversation.
So cute. Oh my God. He's a golden doodle. Oh.
Yeah. I think he agrees with me. And so he just is speaking up about,
No, he was rolling his eyes. He was rolling his eyes. And he gave the, so I think that, where were we?
Isolation Nation.
Yeah. So we did it for the first while after we were nicely or not nicely into the pandemic. And it was just a way for people to hear, which is kind of like my whole, you know, kind of being when it comes to mental health, is to allow people to see that they're not the only ones feeling a certain way. Yeah. So, and it was, you know, talk show format, which obviously mm-hmm. I'm pretty familiar with. And I just think that anything any of us can do that allows people to feel like they're understood. And you can't do that if you haven't been through it. Like one of the things I always say to people when I give a talk is that how many people in the room, and this was, I was speaking to those cops in Fredericton, how many people in the room have battled mental illness? Now think about this. Out of 200 people, only 5 put up their hands. So I said, hey, I respect the fact that there's all kinds of you in this room who chose not to put up your hand because you don't want the people around you to know. And I get that. That's one of the reasons why I'm here, right? So it's not like I'm looking down at you, but I know you're out there. And my goal is to maybe next time allow you to put your hand up. So, and then I said, how many of you have or do care about someone with a mental illness? So either in the past or now, to the point where their illness has actually affected you. And every single person out of 200 put up their hands. All of them had been affected by it, whether it was family or friends or partner who was a cop, every single one of them did. And I was shocked afterwards, or not shocked, that after I give a talk, I'll always just stand there and tell people, hey, you want to come up and chat without everyone hearing. 7 people came up to me afterwards and said, I was one of those people that, you know, I wanted to put my hand up, but I couldn't.
Just couldn't.
And that's why, you know, the sharing that you do on a regular basis, I think has more value than anything. The idea that people can realize that others experience the same things, that they're not unique, and that others have, you know, learned to cope with it, have had it treated, have done better. I think those are really, really important lessons.
I agree. I know we're hitting sort of the 1 hour mark and we've got a few other things going, and I do appreciate your time. So I would love to move on to some of our fun things that we have planned.
Well, I was having fun already, but okay, you know.
That's a take a little sidestep away from the seriousness of this conversation and get into some comedy aspects of this. we previously decided before we were doing the show that we would do a little game called What Not to Say to People with Depression, but make it a little bit funny. And so we each have a couple of points that we'd like to make. And I think, should we go back and forth? I mean, as you pointed out, it is my show, so I should probably.
Sure. Yeah. You call the shots right now. You know, you want me to go or do you want to go?
So I'll go first. The first one I have on my list is what not to say to someone with depression. Number one, you'll get over it.
Yeah. I would say for me, number one, without a doubt, would be kind of letting the drama build here. You should go for a nice walk. And I kind of think that represents all of the things that suggestions that people make to us. And that's like the healthy brain makes to the depressed brain. And the walk represents all of those things. So a hashtag that I use quite often is fuck the walk. Not because, no, yeah, it's not that there's anything wrong.
That needs
wrong
to be on a t-shirt.
Fuck the walk, absolutely. But you see, it's not that there's anything wrong with going for a walk. And there's nothing wrong with me saying to you, you should go for a nice walk. But if I assume that that's a treatment for your mental illness, that's when it's like, fuck the walk.
Yeah. Agreed. Number two, have a cup of tea.
The cup of tea, first of all, I am a big believer that, I'm joking now, okay? But, okay. You know, it's very, I think tea's unmasculine. I think, you know, coffee is what, you know,
dark blend you like.
Yeah. Hmm? Oh, I love coffee, actually. I do love coffee. And I've never really liked tea. So not only is tea not going to help me with my depression, but I'm going to drink it and think, why the fuck am I doing this? This is terrible. Fuck the tea, fuck the walk, fuck all of those suggestions that minimize what it is we're experiencing. You know, don't you think that's what it is? It's the person that says to you, have a nice cup of tea is taking what for you is a devastating illness and making it seem like there's a simple solution.
Yeah. I think for people who don't know what you're going through, I think they feel, and I'm assuming this, I don't know these people, but I would think that they're trying to be helpful. But when you're in that state, you're like exactly what you said. I 100% agree with you, Michael. You are absolutely right. I concur on all of your points. Fuck the walk, fuck the tea.
And I agree with your points as well. And I will say, you know what you shouldn't say to people? Go like, oh God, you look like shit. You know, like, you know, are you okay? Are you sleeping? It's like, you know, I'm not sleeping. You know that because this is not the first time we've had this discussion, you know that I'm battling, you know, this serious illness. You know, I'm in a really bad point right now with my illness. I don't need you to tell me that I look like shit. Okay. You think it all you want. I know I do. But you don't have to tell me. I'm hoping that nobody else notices. I mean, I did probably 1,000 television shows when I was severely depressed. Probably 700, let's say, out of the 4,000 that I did. 700 shows severely depressed, and not one person ever said to me, are you okay? And I think that the lesson that I learned from that is the mask, that you don't know what someone's necessarily thinking. I know that's a bit of a leap away from what I was saying before, but there's an important lesson. Like the person that you sleep beside, or the person, your kid that sleeps down the hall, just because you think they're okay doesn't mean they are okay.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. And it's, the point that you made about sleep is very, very true, very valid. I struggle with sleep quite a bit. I generally don't really sleep. And I don't think people really realize that until they send me a message at like 4 a.m. and I respond right away. And they're like, holy shit, you don't sleep. And I'm like, I told you. Yeah. It takes a lot of work to look like this, people.
That's really funny. Yeah, it's like, you know, you need to give me credit for actually, you know, doing this kind of work, given the circumstances of my life.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, show me a person with mental health challenge and I'll show you a person that probably has really bad sleep. Bad sleep because they want to sleep during the day and then at night they can't.
Yeah, absolutely. The final one I have on my list, you were fine yesterday.
Yeah. Very, very bad thing to say to someone. Were fine yesterday. Or that's a bad thing to say to someone. You were fine yesterday. Yeah. I think I like that, which I guess means I don't like that from the standpoint of, you know, what a crappy thing to say to people. But, you know, there's a whole bunch that are in the same category. My last one would be, what do you have to be depressed about? You know, it's like, no, you don't understand. I don't have anything to be depressed about. You know, yeah. I have a great job. I have a great family. I have great parents. I have all the things that would suggest that I should be happy, but it has nothing to do with that. My illness is not based on my circumstances. It's based on, and this is a medical term, fucked upness in my head.
Fucked upness.
Yeah, it's a medical term.
Yeah. Hashtag. Yeah.
My brother's a doctor, so I know this shit.
Oh, so then, yeah, you by proxy. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Couple rapid fire questions for you.
Fire away.
Okay. Crunchy peanut butter or smooth?
I don't like the crunchy. It doesn't spread as well. It doesn't melt on the bagel as well. I'm a Jew, so I had to bring bagel into the conversation. Crunchy, just I don't get it. Sounds better than it actually is.
Okay, so we're going with smooth because we already know tea is offensive. So fuck the tea.
You know, tea is just, it's just weak.
Next hashtag should be tea, sick in, right. Maybe.
Exactly. And that means that every Brit is weak.
Ooh, ouch.
Because they are obsessed with their tea.
Michael, that's a tricky one.
most of my roots are Eastern European, so so I have no hesitation in insulting the Brits.
Okay, there we go. We've got insurance, right? Okay. Number two, what is the Dewey Decimal System?
That was the library, the codes that they would use on books in the library. So you could, if you could break the code, which apparently the Brits did it, they broke the Enigma code during World War II and the Dewey Decimal System at the same time. So if you understand the Dewey Decimal System, you can locate the book that you're looking for in what were formerly known as libraries. Now they have ceased to exist in their former form.
Bravo. Michael, when did you lose your virginity? And if you say last Thursday, we know you're lying.
No, I would say, I was scared of women. I was scared of girls.
Did you think they were going to throw up?
I was hoping that they wouldn't throw up. Okay. Oh my God, Michael. Oh my God, what is that?
Did you ever watch South Park?
Of course.
There's that skit where, you know, the one kid is so nervous around this girl and the song always plays, "There's a girl that I love."
Yeah. And that, you know, I was a totally different person when I was a teenager than I think maybe broadcasting brought me out and gave me a sense of confidence being in an environment that I can control. Mm. So I would say I was 20.
20. Me too.
See, you know, I'm being honest though. Like, you know, like I always marvel at, like, you hear stories about like the cool guy in school. He was 14 or whatever. It's like 14.
14 is young.
Yeah.
14 is young. I mean, talk about changing your brain chemistry. That's 14 is young.
Yes.
And just for reference, this was one of the questions that Michael had mentioned on one of his podcasts that he said that nobody had asked him yet. So that's why I asked you that question.
You know what? I always give it like in a conversation or in any setting, I say, ask me anything you want. There's not a single question that you could ask me that I wouldn't answer. And that, to me, if you want to be a mental health advocate, is a really important thing to be. I mean, it doesn't matter. Like obviously, you know, like the question you asked me isn't really that important when it comes to mental health.
But it does
reflect actually, you know, who I was and the struggles I had back then with anxiety.
Absolutely. Two more questions. Number four, what's worse for your brain, gluten or cocaine?
I've never tried cocaine, so I can't answer that. I imagine cocaine is worse for your brain. Now, obviously, you're an anti-gluten person, which because you would never, ever have put those two things in the same category. Like it seems like so obvious.
Why would you assume I'm anti-gluten?
Well, because who would ever say, you know, what's worse for your brain? I never heard that gluten's bad for your brain, period.
You
would say, no, that's what I'm saying.
It's a huge discussion.
No, it's not. Oh, no, my God.
Eye roll.
Yeah, well, okay. I was giving you the, I was mentally eye rolling.
Okay.
So tell me what would you say? What's worse for your brain, gluten or cocaine?
I think cocaine cut with gluten would probably fuck you up real bad.
Yeah, you know what? You're clearly not living on the streets, because if you were like a drug dealer on the streets, you would not be talking about cutting your cocaine with gluten. Hello? Yeah,
way too expensive. No, I'm quite comfortable in the West End of the city here.
You know, you told me where you lived. That's not the West End.
I'm not saying it on the show, Michael.
I'm not saying it, but also you could beep it out if you wanted, but I'm not going to say it. But I'm saying that what you described to me, where you live, is not the West End of Toronto.
Okay. Last question I have for you. What is your favorite vintage t-shirt?
Probably, I mean, I have so many of them. At one point, I had like 200 rock band t-shirts, and the pandemic claimed some of them. Moving from our last house to this house, my wife claimed some of them. I mean, I'm very suspicious about where some of them have gone. But I have a Guns N' Roses shirt, that I really like. So I would say, but you're talking to a vintage t-shirt collector. Or maybe the t-shirts aren't vintage, but what's written on them is vintage, right?
I love that. Yeah, absolutely. Love it, love it, love it.
How about you? Let me ask you that question. What's your favorite vintage t-shirt?
I love a good Led Zeppelin t-shirt.
Okay. And why did you ask me about the Dewey Decimal System?
It's a random rapid fire, Michael. I don't make the rules.
I liked it. I just thought, oh, that was kind of weird. But clearly, you know, it's you're feeling a little bit because I'm so good at this. I'm kidding. But that you thought, okay, I got to put him in his position here. So I'm going to ask him a question that's going to make him seem like a fool because.
No,
respect that too. I'm kidding.
They're just random questions.
Okay.
Random
well, next time, fire. Next time I come back, if you'll have me,
of course.
You should make up a whole bunch of those questions. I love that because we used to, on the show that I hosted Off the Record, we used to have a segment called Next Question where guests would be asked all of these questions that we had researched. So like things based on their past. And if they wanted to take a pass one time, they could say next question. So it was so much fun if you got someone who was clever and willing to play along, and it was so terrible if they weren't. It was like, oh my God, stop tape. One sec. I'm just going to go into the control room for a second. And then I go, okay, we're 2 minutes short on the show. We can't play this shit. So I'm totally up for that.
How are you with hot sauces?
I like a hot sauce. Mm-hmm. But not a really hot sauce.
So not a hot sauce challenge question.
I could do the questions for sure, but you know that show is so brilliant. It's such a reflection of our time, right? Where you know if you would have pitched that show, the hot sauce challenge, where you would interview celebrities and ask them questions, and you would intermix tasting chicken wings and hot sauce. If you would have pitched that, first of all, no celebrity would have done it. Like, I don't know how they got the first one to do it. And second of all, anyone who, because the only place you could pitch a show was to television networks, right? You know, before YouTube existed, you would have gotten laughed out of there. People would have said, that is the stupidest thing ever. And now we live in a time where what sounds stupid can be amazing.
Absolutely. Speaking of sounds, if you hear some whining in the background, I also have two little pups that they're in their playpen there. So if you hear any whining,
what kind of dogs?
It's not grandma locked in the basement. It's the pups. two Chihuahua mixes.
Chihuahua mixes.
So like one's a Pomeranian Chihuahua and the other is a Shih Tzu Chihuahua.
Okay.
Yeah. Loves of my life, pain nice. In the arse. I
never... Yeah, you know what? It's really scary how much you love your dog. It's true.
It really is.
Like you have this crazy love for them.
Yeah,
that brings you so much joy.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm sure your dog has been a great support for you as well during your challenges too.
Absolutely. You know, when I'm lying on the couch, which you know, I kind of named it tied to the couch syndrome. You know, you wake up, you wake up and you go, oh, shit, you know, I feel crappy. I'm just going to lie on the couch. And the problem is you lie on the couch for 2 hours and now you start to feel worse about yourself because you're not doing anything. So the depression that you started with gets magnified because you're not doing anything and you're feeding into your own anger that you have with yourself.
It becomes this vicious cycle where you feel bad
vicious
for not doing
cycle.
Anything and then you can't do anything and then you're like fuck.
Yes,
fuck the walk,
exactly.
Fuck the tea.
Fuck the walk, fuck the tea. I'm going to use the tea next time. I'm going to say, you know what?
Hashtag that shit up.
Yeah, hashtag that shit up. That's it's a good combination of that's hashtag that shit up. I like that. Well, well said.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Where can people go to
Euclid Avenue and no, you didn't mean like where I live. Okay.
where do you suggest people start if they're experiencing mental health challenges? What are some of your tips and suggestions on where to sort of navigate, and how can they find you and all of your wonderful resources?
Well, I would say first and foremost, if you're not sure, you need to talk to someone, which, you know, one of the problems I have is that I'm kind of this rah-rah coach to say, you need to go and address this. You need to go and talk to someone. You need to go and get help. The problem is that in the world we live in Canada, especially, there is not access to help for most people. So it's like, okay, you know, and this happens all the time. Someone will say, okay, well, I did what you said, but you know, I now have an appointment with a psychiatrist in 18 months. So, regardless of how difficult the system is, there's no way around it. You need to talk to a professional, and it usually starts by going to your family doctor. And if you have a good family doctor, that will be a really positive visit, where you'll learn where he'll, you know, talk to you or she'll talk to you about the battle that you're going through and the symptoms that would be concerning, and may give you a referral to both a psychologist and a psychiatrist. That's, to me, where you start. But if you're already kind of in the system, I think it's so important to go, okay, I ask people this question all the time. Like I would say to you, Jenna, are you satisfied where you're at right now? And when I say right now, I don't mean like at this time that you and I are talking, but in general, like this week, this month, like just, you overall know, your mental your health life. Overall,
yeah.
Are you satisfied with that? If you were told you have to live the rest of your life the way you are now, would you be okay with that? And that to me is a really good way to evaluate whether you need to continue searching for something else. If the answer is yeah, like I can say, yeah, I'm okay to live the rest of my life with this because of where I've been and how much I appreciate just feeling okay, right? But if you're not okay, then you need to continue to chase the help and maybe different help. If you've gone to the same doctor for 5 years and you're still not in a place that you feel like you could be or should be, then you got to look for another doctor, which is incredibly difficult, right? But you can't settle. Settling for living in a position where you're just not feeling like you're experiencing close to the best that life has to offer, that's a reason to keep searching.
Absolutely. Where can people find you?
And I'll
shout out all your stuff.
I'm on Twitter all the time, at Hey Landsberg. We also at Sick Not Week. I just started on TikTok, as you mentioned, Sick Not Week.
And I love your videos on there, by the way. Love the videos.
Thanks. You know, it's kind of
great.
I'm kind of feeling my way through.
Yeah.
TikTok is this kind of unique way to present information, and it's kind of like all I know is television, right? But you know, if you try to do TV and put it on TikTok, there's something missing from it. So I think the best things that I've done, you know, are like on TikTok, are just when I really speak from the heart and soul. So just Sick Not Week, Google it and find it if you want, and if not, you know, I'm not selling anything. I just think that it's really important to find someone who understands you, who you can go, yeah, you know what? You do get it. And that's kind of what I provide.
So we can't buy a t-shirt with just your face on it.
I didn't say you couldn't buy a t-shirt.
Oh, okay.
Hold on one sec. We're sold out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They couldn't stay on the shelves. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. It's that obnoxious guy from television. Oh my God. I always hated that guy. I want to wear his shirt.
Michael, thank you very, very much for taking the time today. I know we went a little bit over the hour, and your time is valuable, and I appreciate you very much. This is such a great conversation that we had today, and brings so much value to so many people, and I really appreciate you. Thank you so much for being here.
I appreciate being here as much as you just described you appreciating me being here. I loved it. You're awesome, and I had fun, so thank you.
It was a lot of fun. We want to remind everybody to like, share, comment, subscribe. We love the feedback, so make sure you DM or message or leave comments and give us some feedback on how you love the show. And we will see you next week. Bye, everybody.